Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, welcome back. Great to have you with us. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street at Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. All right, we're going to replay an interview I did with Jim Delaney a while back, but it has to do with the college football playoff. Then I'm going to link in some stuff with the college football playoff after the interview is over with. Because Jim Delaney has worked so hard over time to get this together. And in the last 2 years, the Big Ten champion has not been a part of the college football playoff. And that's something that, you know, he had fought for originally. And, you know, and I went through the checklist the other day of Alabama. Let's see, Alabama. Win the division? No. Win the conference? No. Play 10 Power 5 schools in the regular season? No. One national championship. Why do they get the path that others don't? The other three schools, by the way, last year, Oklahoma, Clemson, Georgia, all played 10 Power 5 schools. All of them played 10 Power 5 schools. Alabama played 9 last year in their 12-game schedule in the regular season. Now, I know that people, oh, look at them. Look how great they are. Look how athletic they are. I don't care. You've got to, you know, you also have to do things other people do. Now, we'll talk to and rehash the thoughts of Jim Delaney on that in just a few moments. And then and we're going to hear a replay or interview with Todd Callis in the final half hour, because so many people were so fascinated to hear Harry's son about what he's doing now, but also reminiscing about his dad as well. And we'll do that in the final half hour. First of all, our play-by-play call of the day. How about a double steal by the Cleveland Indians?
Really be able to turn a double play here.
Here goes Ramirez for second, and now Davis coming home, and he is in there. One of the most aggressive base running teams in baseball pulls off their first run of the game.
They're waiting to see if Ramirez should head back to the dugout or not. We do know Davis is safe. It looks like we'll have a replay review.
I think he gets him on the heel. It looks like he makes that tag, and he clips his heel.
Yeah, he got him. And then Ramirez is out.
And that's when he wheels around and makes that throw. I mean, that would have been one of the more incredible double plays I think I've ever seen. But Davis just a little bit too good of a jump, a little bit too fast.
Executed well. They'll take the trade. Cleveland likes to run. Ramirez, like we mentioned, leading the league in stolen bases. He won't get one there, but he helps his team.
Ramirez was called out, but Davis was safe at the plate, so that's enough execution to get a run home, and they get the job done as the Indians execute a double steal yesterday. All right. This goes back a few months, but I had an opportunity to talk to Jim Delaney about the college football playoff, the emotion of it, not getting the conference champion in each of the last 2 years. It's something he has fought for. So let's get his thoughts on that. Then I'm going to move the thoughts ahead to this upcoming year and how the college football playoff committee needs to make a few statements, essentially, as to what they think teams should be doing.
There's no person on the planet that worked harder to get two than you did, okay, in the BCS. I know that with all the politics. So after going through now 4 years of this, how do you feel how it's played out and laid out now that we have a sample size?
Yeah, in some respects, good. You know, obviously I was disappointed, you know, not only this year, but last year that our champion wasn't selected. But that was one of the arguments at the time. You know, I argued for the champions to be selected. And I wasn't successful in that argument. Where I've been disappointed is I thought the champions designation would carry more weight than it has to date. Think about this. We've had 4 years, and we had four times four, or 16. They're in conferences, but there are five conferences who created this entity. We always knew that there would be time to time, conflict. Somebody would be out. It was actually designed that somebody would be out, not because we wanted to hurt anybody. We just thought that four was the maximum we could handle. It was better for the student. It was better for the one semester sport. The fan might want 8 or 12 or 16, but it wasn't something that from a, university-sponsored football college situation that we can handle. Now, not only have two of our champions not been involved, but there have been 13 champions or co-champions, I think that's right, that have not been involved. We've had two, maybe 13 is not the right. We've had two not included. The Pac-12 has had two not included. I guess it's seven. And then there have been three either champions or co-champions in the Big 12. So, we knew that.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
No, so I was just saying we knew there would be some exclusion. There have been two drivers at large teams, Alabama and Ohio State. I wasn't sure that we would have any, but I was very much surprised. Last year, Penn State, was in a head-to-head with, because of the seedings, with Washington. Now, I thought Penn State had a stronger resume myself. They beat Ohio State, and they didn't have an FCS team on their resume. I can't relitigate that. I had already seen a two-loss Stanford team, a two-loss Oklahoma team out, and one-loss teams at Baylor and I think it was TCU. So, not to relitigate, but I've been definitely disappointed to some extent. But give me the interest and the following and the impact it's had on regular season have all been positive. And just because it mean that you're going to turn on the dime. I think a sample size of 4 years or 6 years begins to give you a picture, and then we'll just sort of look at it. But my first reaction is not an expansion. My first reaction is not to accuse anybody. My first reaction is disappointment, and we need to do better, and we need to go out and play some great bowl games. We need to win and be successful, and it's been an interesting week.
The other part that is also in common with the champions that have not been involved in this is that each one of those conferences happened to be the three that all play nine games. So in other words, a crossover game by Ohio State, for example, it happens to be Iowa in November and not Mercer or the Citadel.
Yep.
How difficult is it, because obviously conferences have autonomy, to get everybody on the same page where everybody, for example, because I like the Big Ten playing nine, Jim. I thought great move. But how difficult is it to get everybody on the same page?
Well, that's part of the disappointment, that I don't think it's been recognized of the different level of competitive challenge between playing eight and nine and no FCS and one FCS. So that's been part of my, we have an opportunity to introduce information, to bring people up to speed on what we're accomplishing. And I can tell you, we did the major intersectional, the nine games. We did all of that to catch the attention and the respect of the committee. And I'd have to tell you that, Washington had an FCS game, and Penn State lost a close game to a good Pittsburgh team that beat Clemson earlier in the year by 3 points. I think Iowa has won, four games against top five teams in the last 8 or 9 years. So we're not the only ones, but we do it because we're trying to impress the committee. And I think we also do it because it's the right thing to do to build a conference. And I think the Big 12 and the Pac-12 agree. But to date, the committee has it, in my view, that they tend to focus on the losses, and they not necessarily on the overall strength. This year, we had more games against FBS. We won more games against FBS. We had the fewest FCS, and we didn't make it. But we just maybe have to do a better job of having more conversations But the facts that you bring up are on target.
And again, I'm with you with the nine-game schedule. I thought it would to begin with anyway, and that then goes to the basketball picture. The last time you were on, I said, how much interest will you have in that first December weekend as to how it plays out, attendance and interest? And you said very interested. Now you've had to see a payoff there, Jim?
I thought, you know, between the ACC Big Ten Challenge and the first week of basketball in the Gavitt Games, I haven't been able to go year to year looking at attendance and ratings and so on, but I definitely think that all that taken together as a whole was helpful to basketball in breaking through a time period, which is typically football overwhelms the round ball game. I thought it was good. We won't know, you know, how long does it take to change a habit? How long does it take to get people to make appointments and get comfortable? That's a big change. But, you know, if you've watched us over the years, whether it's the basketball challenges that we take on or whether it's the nine-game football schedule, we tend to believe that playing quality opponents over time builds interest. Players and fans like it. And eventually I think it will impress. But I think it's fairly true that the nine-game schedules have not had any advantage over the eight-game schedules. But let's not also forget that the teams playing eight-game schedules are good football teams as well.
No, there's no question. There's no question about that. But the Big Ten takes on the challenge within its own conference of scheduling up because they're scheduling within the conference, and that's going to be the case in both football and then with the 20-game schedule in basketball next year. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's probably fair. You know, I would say that the basketball committee has been, you know, working for, you know, probably decades. And I think strength of schedule and you're also talking about, you know, 34 automatic qualifiers and 30 at-larges or 30 at-larges, 34 automatic qualifiers. And so, you know, I would say the football committee is newer. I know this, you know, because we've had a number of chairmen from this group. I've chaired that group. You know, winning 20 games was never entry into anything. Pretty much a fine art of taking apart schedules that he selected as at-larges with 16 wins, if they're the right wins. So I'm not, you know, I think they're pretty adept. They have a, you know, a good sample size, like 40 years. Whereas the football committee, I think everyone's just trying to understand how it works.
Right.
4 years.
Exactly.
16 teams. I mean, the basketball committee will select 16 teams in the first two. So it's a little bit different. And I think yet the football group has tried to emulate and follow some of the processes and procedures, but there's just so many fewer data points.
I know. And final question for you, Jim, and I'll let you go. Appreciate the time. And that deals with the student athlete. Certain elements have been implemented, cost of attendance, nutrition, fueling stations, and so forth. Do you feel that those are positive steps that are really helping intercollegiate athletics right now? You know, because there are steps that had to be made, but now that you've had a sample size, you like the direction of it.
Not only positive, but necessary. You know, when I was in school, 60s and early 70s, we had the 4-year scholarship. We had the $15 a month laundry money. You know, the training wasn't nearly as sophisticated and as focused. And so when we did away with the multi-year grant, when we did away with the $15 a month, those were not good moves for college sports, in my view. So I think that a lot of the things that we've tried to implement, whether it's the voice and vote of the student at the NCAA convention, whether it's the multi-year commitment to education, whether it's the fueling stations or whether the cost of attendance, all good things, all necessary. And I'm pleased that we've come into a more balanced place with regard to the students who are playing college sports.
Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time that you always give us. We really appreciate it.
And Jim Delaney, the commissioner of the Big Ten. And this now sets up what I want to talk about. And that has to do with, you know, what they're doing with the college football playoff. Penn State starts practice tomorrow. You would idealistically like to see an even playing field, a level playing field. There is not a level playing field. You know, I don't care what the committee says. Oh, no, we look at this, we look at, oh, please, okay? there has to be some basic standards. And I understand why Jim Delaney wanted nothing but conference champions. Now, can an argument be made that, you know, there's a great team, especially the way they play down the stretch, and they deserve to be in? Well, guess what? 2 years ago, that's what Penn State was. They were the team that won 9 games in a row down the stretch. They were the team that beat Ohio State here. They, you know, they were the team that beat Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, right? And they ended up getting the Rose Bowl. Certainly, I mean, that's no consolation prize. That's a great prize. But they weren't allowed to play for the national championship because they, quote, had 2 losses. And the thought process always was you can overcome an early loss. Okay, well, Penn State had 2 early losses, but then all of a sudden hit stride and won 9 in a row. So did you take the best team at that time? And the question is, did you take the most deserving team at the time? Well, I don't think they ended up taking either. I thought Penn State was more deserving than Washington, and I thought Penn State was better than Washington. Right? But Washington played it safe, played a non-conference schedule where the best team was Rutgers. They got in, so they took advantage of it. It seems like the schools that have taken advantage of the system, and let's give Washington credit, by playing Rutgers, by the way, they played 10 Power 5 teams. Rutgers a Power 5 team when they played them. Maybe at the bottom of the Big Ten, but they're a Power 5 school. Right? Last year, Clemson played 10 Power 5 schools, Georgia played 10, and Oklahoma played 10. Alabama played 9 last year. Alabama played 9. This is where I'm getting to in the level playing field. Alabama, well, you know, I mean, look how great they are. They deserve to be in. All they had to do was beat Auburn, and there's no arguing about what's going on. Well, to me, Auburn essentially, at that time of the year, is a playoff game. They lost it. And yet they were given the benefit of the doubt. Remember the argument I made the year Ohio State won, 2014? TCU was 3rd. Baylor was, I think, 5th in the next-to-last college football playoff ranking. And Ohio State, I think, was 6th. And Ohio State beat Wisconsin, blew them out. Cardale Jones, I mean, they shut them out, crushed them. Ohio State moved into the top 4. TCU moved to 5th, Baylor to 6th. My argument then was quite simple. Why do you look at, in that particular year, I think it was Ohio State, Alabama, it was Oregon and Florida State. On championship weekend, Oregon, Florida State, Alabama, and Ohio State all played. And my argument back then was on this show, I was very plain about it, is that why do you ask those 4 schools to clear a 13th hurdle, and not only you're clearing a 13th hurdle on that particular weekend, but you're also playing, at worst, a very good team. Because guess what? You're playing the other division champion. So at worst, you're playing a very good team. I'm not saying you're playing a great team, but at worst, you're playing a very good, really good team. Why do you ask them to clear a 13th hurdle, and this other conference doesn't have to clear that hurdle, they just have to clear 12. And that was the argument I made back then. Well, now let's fast forward it to now. Why was it that, for example, Ohio State last year had to clear a 13th hurdle, and Alabama didn't? Why was it that Ohio State played 10 Power 5 schools, including Oklahoma, which they lost to, and Alabama didn't? You know, I mean, you can go on. I mean, Ohio State last year won its division, won its conference, played 10 Power 5 schools. Alabama didn't either. They got in. They didn't have to do the heavy lifting that other people have to do. They didn't have to do it. And that's, you know, that goes back to what Jim Delaney talked about, the disappointment in the system. College Football Playoff Committee needs to be making statements to schools about, look, this is what we expect. If you're going to try and play for the national championship, you're going to play for the national championship, you have to put together a national championship schedule. Alabama has played 2 road games in non-conference under Nick Saban. His last one was at Penn State in 2011. All of his other early season games where they play another Power 5 school are neutral games. Neutral. All right. Final Laugh Hour coming up. Great to have you with us. Brought to you by our good friends at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. On News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Great to have you with us on the show today. Obviously, the big story in college football has been about Urban Meyer. And Ohio State placing him on paid administrative leave while they look into how he handled and what his knowledge of Zach Smith's home situation was. And not, I mean, I think they're mostly looking at 2015. I think it's acknowledged he knew about the 2009 incident because it's been, the story's been told that Urban and Shelley Meyer urged counseling in 2009. So that does establish prior knowledge of other incidents. Now the question is, what will happen and what his knowledge was of 2015. Eventually, he had to fire Zach Smith and did so a couple of weeks ago. And now Brian Hartline is the wide receiver coach for Ohio State. Ryan Day, for the moment, is the interim coach for Ohio State as they start training camp, and they'll do that tomorrow. And my thought process on Ryan Day was simple. All right, you've got Kevin Wilson, former Indiana head coach. Okay, why not him? Well, accused of mistreating his players in some sectors at Indiana. So you don't want to go there. Greg Schiano. Well, you recall everything swirling around Greg, fair, unfair, when he was about to be offered the Tennessee job. So I don't think Ohio State wanted to go there. Now there's the other factor. Courtney Smith, ex-wife of Zach Smith, saying straight out, all the wives knew. Well, all the wives knew probably because Courtney Smith was telling them. She was trying to lean on as many people as possible to help her get through what was obviously a nearly impossible situation for her. So she said all the wives knew. Okay. Well, if all the wives knew, then there is a strong possibility that one can add 2 plus 2 and have it equal 4 that the husbands knew. Okay. So on this staff, Brian Hartline aside, who would have potentially the least knowledge of anybody? And that would be Ryan Day, the quarterback coach and co-offensive coordinator. Why? He just joined the staff last year. So I think that's why they went that direction. They're going to go with a coordinator on the staff that has had the least amount of time on staff, except for obviously Brian Hartline, which then would potentially mean that he would have the least knowledge, if any knowledge, of what happened with Zach Smith. That's why I think they did that. I think they took all those pieces and put it together, and that to me is a statement unto itself as to how they feel about this investigation as well. So they want to, quote, resolve it as quickly as possible. This isn't going to be that easy. It's not going to be easy at all. And for Urban Meyer, we'll see if he coaches this year for Ohio State. If he does, that means whatever internal investigation they had cleared him. He gave the right explanations. Whatever. or whether they decide to cut bait and move on, which would be obviously one of the biggest stories of the year in college football. But the bottom line is, I mean, and I believe Courtney Smith accuses him, I think she's accused him of stalking her boyfriend now. I mean, there's a long list here. I mean, this is not just an incident happened here, an incident happened there. There's a lot more to this story than people realize. And for Brett McMurphy, he was able to break this down, and he's the one that has broken the story. Now you're going to have a greater swirl surrounding this each and every day, and it's going to be important. And here's the other part. You want to get all the answers, so time should not mean anything here. You want to make sure you have all the correct answers. You want to make sure that whatever comes out is the truth, and then we can judge the truth instead of judging speculation. So let's just judge the truth and not speculation. So time should not mean anything. It doesn't matter that they're going to camp tomorrow. It doesn't matter that the opening game is September 1st. That doesn't matter. You want to have all the right answers in place so that then you make the proper judgment as to whether to move forward with Urban Meyer or move forward without Urban Meyer. But you can't do that unless you have all the facts. And, you know, well, camp's starting tomorrow. So what? Season starts in a month. So what? Doesn't matter if the season starts 4 weeks from Saturday. However long it takes to get the right answers is all that matters. Because the right answers make the investigation fair and makes the judgment fair. We had Todd Callis on the show last week, Harry's son. We had a lot of people saying they wanted to hear that interview again. It's interesting because Harry began his career as the Astros play-by-play guy, then took the Phillies job. Now, Todd, of course, has been with the Mets. He's been with the Phillies and spent a long time with the Tampa Bay Rays. Then last year, he took the Astros job, and last week I had a chance to talk with him.
Hey, no problem, Steve. How's it going?
It's going really well. I hope everything's going well for you. So again, it's a terrific ball club that the Astros have this year. I want to start with the Maldonado. Gold Glove winner, awesome arm. Was that an element that the Astros felt they needed, especially against a couple of the running games in the American League like the Indians and Red Sox?
Yeah, I think so. They could have gone forward and had Tim Fedorovich and Max Stassi continue to catch, but I think whenever you can add a defensive specialist like a Martin Maldonado coming off a Gold Glove season, they may end up going with three catchers in the postseason. So I think when Brian McCann comes back, I think he'll still be the lead dog in the catching trio, but I also think you're going to see the mix and match with Maldonado and also with Stassi.
Is there anything else you think the Astros might need? I mean, this is a team playing almost 650 baseball, for goodness sakes, but they're also in a league where there are two other teams doing the same thing. Is there anything else that you think that they might need, or should the Astros be okay where they are now?
You always look to improve if you can. If they can make a deal that maybe shores up the bullpen a little bit, maybe even a guy that can finish out a game, I'm sure that's something that Jeff Luhnow and his staff are looking at right now. They've been using Hector Rondon, and he's done a nice job, but they could also use another guy locking down late in a game, especially for the postseason. So I think that's where their main focus is. They may look to add a position player if somebody becomes available, but right now I think for the most part they're fine. Their rotation is just filled with five studs, and they just need to figure out a way to get a little better locking down some games with leads at the end.
Yeah, one of those five studs goes tonight, and that's Dallas Keuchel. And State College fans saw him pitch when he was at Tri-City. But, about a year ago, maybe a little bit more than that, he complained that, gee, they're not adding anybody, and they added then Justin Verlander. Can you explain to everyone the impact? On the field, impact's obvious, but has there been a real impact as to what he's meant to the organization and that staff off the field?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, Justin Verlander sets the bar so high, and Dallas was the man before JV got here. And now with Verlander and Gerrit Cole and Charlie Morton all reaching the postseason, all five of the guys in the rotation have now been, or actually with those three making the All-Star team, all five of those guys have been in the All-Star game the last couple of years. So it's a pretty phenomenal group. Dallas has pitched very well in July, but going back to your question, yes, Verlander makes a difference on the mound, but also sets the tone in the clubhouse too. He's so meticulous in his preparation. He just locks in and goes through as much video as any starting pitcher you'll see. And then the day he pitches, he is just laser focused. So I think that could only help. Each guy's got a little different personality, but I think when you go out there and see the success that Verlander has at age 35, and you kind of look to see how he prepares going into a start, it can only help the other four guys.
Pirate fans may wonder, why have Gerrit Cole and Charlie Morton been better in Houston than they were in Pittsburgh?
Well, Morton actually started throwing the ball when he was with the Phillies for those brief outings before he got hurt 2 years ago. He was starting to throw the ball a little better with the Phillies. I think for Gerrit Cole, it's just a matter of letting that four-seam fastball eat and not relying on that two-seamer down and in. I think Morton, to an extent, was also more of a ground ball pitcher when he was with the Pirates, and now he's able to get more strikeouts. I think both guys are not pitching to contact as much as they're pitching up in the zone at times and just letting that four-seamer ride. And Cole's got a fastball that's elite. He can bring it around 100 miles an hour. And while Morton doesn't touch 100, his average fastball is around 95, 96. He never threw that hard with the Pirates. He was more about hitting his spots down and in on that two-seamer. And now that he and both Gerrit are letting that fastball eat a little bit, it's really had a lot of success and one of the reasons they've done so well with the Astros.
Yeah, Morton's biggest problem when he was here, he always had that one inning. For something, three innings, he looks great. Then all of a sudden, he'd have that one inning, and everybody go, okay, here we go. It seems like he's avoided that one inning.
He does to an extent, but every once in a while, it's strange. Like, he's a guy that is, once he gets a little bit out of whack with his rhythm and his mechanics, you can see him lose it for about an inning. And we have seen that on occasion this year. There was a start against the Texas Rangers where he hit four batters and he walked another five or six. There was a start against the Arizona Diamondbacks where he walked four in the first inning. So it comes and goes, and usually he's locked in and he's on point. But every once in a while, he'll get out of rhythm, and it seems like it takes him a little while to find that zone again. But what Charlie's done for this team has been remarkable over two seasons. When you talk about a guy who won two Game 7s last year in the postseason for the first time anybody's ever done that, and then an all-star this year and well-deserved. So maybe not having that big blow-up inning like he did with the Pirates in terms of runs allowed, but occasionally he'll get out of his rhythm every once in a while.
They certainly have stars, Springer, and obviously Altuve, who's just must be awesome to watch him on an everyday basis. Same thing with Correa. What's made Alex Bregman really come into his own the last year and a half?
That's a good question. I think just the fact that he's having success and that builds confidence. And he's always been a confident kid, even from the time he came up and really struggled his first few weeks. He always knew that he had the ability and the skill to play at this level. But he has done things this year that if you asked at the beginning of the year which infielder was going to have the best season, very few would have picked Alex Bregman. But he's been the guy. He's been the best offensive player on this team in 2018. He just has locked in the zone even better than he ever did before. He very, very rarely leaves the zone. Occasionally, he'll come up on a pitch that's a little bit up in the zone and swing at that. But for the most part, he's one of the best plate discipline guys you'll find, not only on this team, but in the league. And then he's not missing his pitch. Once he gets that pitch that he likes, he's usually doing damage with it. If it's not a home run, it's a double, or if it's a ball, it's a ball hit hard somewhere. So he's been locked in now for really about a two and a half month stretch, and he's kind of carried this team while Correa's been hurt, and it's great to see. He's a baseball rat. You won't find a guy to take more swings or do more reps on the field or work in the cage any harder than Alex Bregman, and the work pays off.
What's it been like for you on an everyday basis to watch Altuve and Correa perform?
I enjoyed them when I was coming in as a visitor when I worked for the Tampa Bay Rays for all those years. But now that I get to watch them for 162, it's really special. I mean, they have a unique relationship in the middle of the infield that you don't see very often. They play the game kind of like little leaguers play or back in AAU days where they just have such a joy for the game and they play it that way. And so to watch them with the skills they have play the game like a little kid is quite a combination. And Carlos has been hurt here for the last month or so. So the Astros will find that a little more today, but they're hoping to get him back sooner than later, hopefully in the next week or so. And then Altuve's banged up a little bit with a little knee contusion, so he may not be in the lineup tonight. But to watch those guys day in and day out, and to start with Altuve at second and Correa at short as your kind of centerpieces to this team, you're so much further advanced than any other team in baseball with those two being your middle infielders that it's kind of in a way unfair, but it's a nice problem for the Astros to have because it's fun to watch them every day.
I was explaining earlier that when Fran Fischer was the play-by-play voice of Penn State football, basketball, he didn't do postseason games. The first one he did was at the Sugar Bowl against Georgia. All those other years he didn't. Now in my role, I do every bowl game, every postseason game. Last year, you did the regular season, then it got the postseason. You had to become a spectator. What was that like?
A little different, and I kind of got used to working pre- and post-game shows for the Rays whenever they got to the postseason, that run of 4 out of 6 years from 08 through 13. So I kind of got used to working in some realm, even though it wasn't working our normal TV role. But it was a little different this year. I mean, last year, for sure. I knew going in that that was part of the deal, that the Astros just didn't do anything with the postseason in terms of their coverage on AT&T. So I knew that going in. But at the same time, it's difficult when you stay with a team for 162 and then you get to the postseason and you are not basically allowed to do your job. But that's every TV broadcaster for every major league team knows that's the deal kind of going in. So it was fun to be a fan. What a run it was to be a fan. And we had a lot of good times in the seats and the stands with my wife and cheering on the Astros. But it was a little different not being in the booth for sure.
I'll give you a little anecdote, then I'll ask the question. The anecdote is this. On top of what I do here, I also teach a sports broadcasting class here at Penn State. And in the first class I have, I'll always ask them, where are you from? What's your favorite sport, favorite team? Who's your favorite broadcaster? Now, obviously, Penn State's a big university, so they'll come from all over the country. But the vast majority, as you know, will be from Pennsylvania. And I'd say 60% of those are from eastern Pennsylvania. You'd be shocked to know, probably, that all these years later, and these are all young people that are 20 and 21 years of age, I'd say 2 out of every 3 from eastern Pennsylvania name your father as their favorite sports broadcaster. I just want to pass that anecdote. I mean, that to me is really neat when young people still revere him like that to this day because they were very young when they heard him.
That's really cool. I love that.
Yeah, I just want to make sure you knew that. And the question is as follows. What did you pick up from him that you still do today? That's part of you. I mean, Todd Cowles is Todd Cowles, so he has to do the job your own way. But what did you pick up from him that are basics that are still a staple for you today? And was there another broadcaster that gave you an influence too?
Yeah, in terms of Dad's influence, I always kind of, we have similar intonations and similar ways we call things, but I think, you know, we have our own styles as well. But I always appreciated that Dad was never afraid to just let, you know, spaces in the broadcast sit there and not have to fill them up. And I think when you let the game breathe, especially the game of baseball, when you're there for 162 games for an average of 3 hours a game, if you don't have anything important to say, it's not worth really filling up the broadcast, just because there's so much ambient sound anyhow. And the stadium kind of lives on its own without a broadcaster saying anything. So I kind of picked that up from him, and his pacing was always a little slower and a little more deliberate than a lot of other announcers, and I think I kind of have him a little more laid-back broadcast style because of that. In terms of other influences, I mean, I always watched the other guys that Dad worked with, and I always appreciated how Andy Muster and Chris Wheeler and Richie Ashburn blended with the broadcast, but in terms of the other broadcasters around the league, I always admired and was a big fan of Skip Carey and how, even though the Atlanta Braves weren't always very talented in some of those years that he was broadcasting, he always kept it entertaining and he kept things loose on the broadcast. So I think that's important too, and I learned that through the years filling in on Ray's broadcast, is when you don't have a very good team, it's hard to, you know, talk strategy and dissect the game every night. It's good to have a little levity every once in a while, and Skip certainly brought that. So I guess that would be something else I would take from a broadcaster other than Dad.
That's interesting. By the way, the last 20 years I've worked with Jack Ham, he often speaks fondly of your father. And I'm talking like a couple times a season, he'd bring up your father's name to me because of how much you enjoy working on Westwood with him. So I just want to make sure you knew that too.
Thank you. Yeah, and occasionally they would head down and do a Buccaneers game, and I would catch up with them, and we would have dinner together. So I got to know Jack a little bit. So tell him I said hello, and I appreciate that he still brings up Dad's name a lot. That's great.
Yeah. Absolutely. Hey, you've carved out your own legacy. You're doing great, great work. Anytime on MLB Network, I get a chance to watch the Astros and hear it. It's really, really special. And congratulations on what you're doing and also the fact the Astros are so good.
Oh, thank you so much. It was, quite a year to come over. I couldn't have picked a better timing. But, yeah, it's all worked out well. I still have a lot of great friends in the Tampa Bay area that I go and visit every now and then. But, the timing couldn't have been any better to join the Astros for sure.
Just make sure that they understand that you're actually the good luck charm. Just make sure they know that.
I'm sure it has a little something to do with the guys at the dugout, but I'll take 0.01% credit. How about that?
Perfect. Todd, thanks so much for the time. I know you got a game tonight with the Rangers, so appreciate the fact that you gave us a few minutes today.
All right, Steve, you got it. Good talking to you.
That's Todd Callis, the Astros play-by-play announcer. All right, it's been another obviously busy news cycle with what's happening in Columbus with Urban Meyer. And the investigation continues. A lot of reporters are now on this story. And they start camp tomorrow. But again, time should be irrelevant to this. Only the facts should be in play here. It doesn't matter the season starts in 4 weeks. That is irrelevant. It's only facts so we can get the right answers. We'll talk to you tomorrow on News Radio 1070 WKOK.